Hey everyone, this is Will Beeman from the Money on the Left Editorial Collective. I'm excited to present the first in a series of lectures on the Russian literary theorist Mikhail Bakhtin. My colleagues Scott Ferguson and Rob Hawks just released a discussion on postmodernism that I encourage you to check out if you enjoy this. The experience of reading Mikhail Bakhtin is a lot like reading a later post-structural theorist like Bart or Derrida, but with his own distinct set of concepts and vocabulary. I've spent a lot of time with Bakhtin in the past year, and what follows will begin to explain my interest, starting with one of his later works on the French Renaissance writer François Rabelais and Bakhtin's explications of carnivalesque humor and forms, which he traces from the medieval carnival through Renaissance and Romantic literary genres. Bakhtin offers a description of the medieval carnival as an important institution that subversively parodies the self-serious prohibitions and boundaries enforced by legal and religious authorities. As the medieval church dramatically disavows carnival as profane, carnival gestures dramatically disavow the very idea of a dramatic disavowal. I feel I should also mention that Bakhtin is speaking to me a lot right now in the context of growing right-wing attacks on social nonconformity of all kinds, particularly efforts to force queer people back into closets through legislation and calls to violence and hate crimes. Attacks on drag and ballroom that equate the public visibility of any non-traditional experiences of gender with pedophilia remind me of the anti-Semitic canards and blood libel of the early modern period. And although drag and ballroom is being targeted right now, it's important not to erase its powerful presence in public life as a real institution that carries some of the carnival spirit of subversive and parodic participation in the very mainstream and public institutions that disavow it. I hope you'll enjoy the following lecture, and if you do, I hope you'll also consider becoming a patron of the Money on the Left Editorial Collective at patreon.com/molsuperstructure. Bakhtin was a literary theorist who did most of his work in the first half of the 20th century, and then it wasn't really published and made very widely available until the 1960s and 1970s. He dies in 75, and that's when literary departments especially start paying attention to him. So he's a literary theorist. He's most known for writing about Dostoevsky. I'm going to be talking about a text that is the introduction to a book that he did on the French Renaissance writer François Rabelais. I'm not even going to try with the French pronunciation, but they would say the R a little bit differently. And although he's a literary theorist, his work, I think it's pretty widely accepted, to at least some degree, has political, allegorical meaning. So Bakhtin himself was exiled to Kazakhstan in 1928. It was because of his kind of relationship to Leninism and Bolshevism, but then later to Stalinism, which was as a kind of political interlocutor and participant in theoretical, political, and aesthetic debates about what life should look like in the, you know, post-revolutionary society. But he's doing this as somebody who's not himself a Bolshevik, is not a Marxist or a Leninist, and in particular, his own religious faith gets him in trouble with Stalin's secret police and political exile. So he doesn't return to the university setting again until the late 1930s. And what I'm going to be talking about today is actually was the introduction to his dissertation, which he wrote during World War II. And it was not published until the 1960s, and officially it's about François Rabelais, a French Renaissance writer who, at the time that Bakhtin is writing about him, is this canonical literary figure, but he sort of baffles people. And Bakhtin's argument is that in order to understand Rabelais, you need to understand a particular kind of humor and laughter that is not just pointless or nihilistic or aimless, but actually has deep philosophical and social and political meaning, and that derives from a lot of medieval practices of parody, and especially around the institution of the medieval carnival. And so this introduction is about carnival humor, carnival laughter, carnivalesque aesthetics, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then he also theorizes at what he calls grotesque realism, which is going to be, on his reading, quite distinct from the usual Renaissance kind of sublime physical experiences, that there's actually something weirdly, he wouldn't say the word transcendent, but transcendent about bodies that seem to, you know, outgrow themselves. And this is an artifact of the fact that we are always changing, but also that it has a deep social and political meaning. And it reminds us that what we take very, very seriously as social institutions that have cleanly defined rules and boundaries, and, you know, are clearly delineated in all ways, are in fact not only subject to change in the future, but aren't even identical to themselves in the present. And that's really what's going to be the key to his understanding of what the medieval carnival was. And often when this essay is taught, in my opinion, I think it gets, we tend to back project, you know, something like the Paris Commune or some sort of an autonomous zone or something like that onto the medieval carnival. So the medieval carnivals were a time of the year. They would last for several months. And during that time, there was a suspension of rules, a declared suspension of rules, which I think is a really important irony here. And I think that this often gets misread as, you know, a kind of a naive sort of, you know, maybe a release valve, and it really has nothing to do with politics or with how the world is. And I think that the history that Bakhtin traces is a lot more messy than that. Carnival really was an institution. The medieval carnival that he discusses is an institution that has roots going back at least as far as Saturnalia festivals in Rome, Athenian comedy, which is not just a kind of nihilistic negation of what is serious, but it actually is constitutively part of what is serious and reminding us of its ephemerality and instability through kind of performative disavowals of these very self-serious stories and productions and institutions and things that we're all familiar with that are all about drawing clear lines between what's good and bad and disavowing. Bakhtin is going to say the role of humor, and especially the kind of humor that we find in the medieval carnival, is much more about undermining these institutions, but rather than simply negate them and, you know, establish different institutions. You know, the goal of carnival was not to overthrow, you know, society and install a society where all the roles were reversed or something. You know, how could it be? It was all the same people. He writes, Carnival does not know footlights in the sense that it does not acknowledge any distinction between actors and spectators. Footlights would destroy a carnival, as the absence of footlights would destroy a theatrical performance. Carnival is not a spectacle seen by the people. They live in it, and everyone participates because its very idea embraces all the people. While carnival lasts, there's no other life outside it. During carnival time, life is subject only to its laws, that is, the laws of its own freedom. It has a universal spirit. It is a special condition of the entire world, of the world's revival and renewal. That is, carnival is a condition of the whole world, right? It's not just this time of year that everything is suspended. Rather, this time of year thematizes the fact that the way that the world is set up is not even identical to itself in the first place. And we often, I think, reading this now, especially as leftists and as, you know, modern political thinkers who are thinking in terms of sovereignty and regimes as being identical to themselves and having, you know, unfolding in ways that are identical to the rules that they name, we tend to want to look at an institution like Carnival and sort of, you know, say, okay, well, did it overthrow feudalism or something like that? And I don't think that history moves in ways, even during times of revolutions when there is a group that has a more or less credible claim to overthrowing another regime. I think that historical causality is always a lot more complicated than that and, you know, involves a lot more voices and legibilities themselves changing because of events that are maybe externally related. You know, there's this saying, right, that like insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expressing a different result. But actually, in the real world, sometimes something else in the world changes so that the same thing does express, beget a different result. One example of this that I have been thinking, which is very perhaps off topic from Bakhtin, but I have really been enjoying Jon Stewart's recent clips where he talks to, you know, I mean, he's basically doing the Jon Stewart shtick from the early 2000s. Nothing about the shtick has changed, but I think that in the early and mid 2000s, when he was, you know, telling media to take some responsibility, it sort of felt like he was speaking to an audience that viewed itself as smug and superior, and, you know, the idea that it was punching up somehow, it didn't really register. But now seeing him do the same shtick in order to, you know, whether it's defend trans people from anti-trans bills or, you know, gun lobby people, you know, like there's a lot of things that have happened in the last few years that have changed how the same thing has been received, right? And so I don't think that retrospectively we can judge the intrinsic qualities of something like, you know, the Jon Stewart shtick as if they exist in a vacuum, right? As if they don't involve and depend on reception from a wider world in which many different things change all the time. And for reasons that are not directly related to the thing that we are kind of, you know, measuring for its political potency or you know, content, as if that is intrinsic to it and not a way, you know, rather than A causing B, I think it's usually better to think about A, B, C, D, and E coming together in some way. And that's usually a much messier story. But that's, I think, something that I just want to stress as we talk about Carnival and assess Carnival, which is that this is an institution that is very, very old, predates many, you know, scientific socialist periodizations of this or that mode of production probably did different things at different points. There are carnivals after the medieval carnival, such as in the 20th century and to today, such as carnival in New Orleans that have been through different periods contested and segregated and have become symbols of the right. And so I don't want to get stuck on adjudicating some kind of question of whether carnival is, is it a revolutionary institution or is it not a revolutionary institution? I think that a lot of things go into whether or not something is a revolutionary institution, and a lot of things that aren't that institution itself. But what is intrinsic to the medieval carnival, and what I do want to talk about, is what Bakhtin is going to describe as the kind of style of its humor. And even this, I should say, is not fully intrinsic to carnival as an institution. I'm sure that, this is not an empirical historical claim that this is what carnival meant to every single person who participated in it, or that there is some, objective way to determine what carnival meant on net at any given time. But the point is that there is a linguistic and a semantic and a cultural, lineage or story, you could say. It's by no means a neat story, by no means a story that is one tradition being passed down in some kind of a flat linear way or something without, being hermetically sealed from other traditions or something. But there is something to the logics of carnival performance and carnival humor that Bakhtin is really, really interested in, and for him is going to be the key to understanding what Rabelais is up to. And so now I want to quote Bakhtin, some of his initial remarks on carnivalesque humor. So here's what he says. He says, "It is, first of all, a festive laughter. It is not an individual reaction to some isolated, quote, comic event. Carnival laughter is the laughter of all the people. Second, it is universal in its scope. It is directed at all and everyone, including the carnival's participants. Third, this laughter is ambivalent. It is gay, triumphant, and at the same time mocking, deriding. It asserts and denies, buries and revives." And so let's unpack what he means by that. Carnival laughter is the laughter of all the people, right? So this is as opposed to humor that is specifically aimed at destroying some kind of, some particular institution from a claimed position utterly outside of that institution. So humor as negation would be this view. And I think that this is what we think of often, like this is what a modern parody is. And he's saying that this particular kind of laughter is this laughter that implicates the person who's laughing. He says it's directed at everyone, including the carnival's participants. And this is going to map onto the way that the carnival's parody of official declarations of law and sovereignty are also self-implicating, right? Because you have somebody who is basically a clown telling you a bunch of rules that you've never heard before, right? And so you're not going to take these rules at face value, right? It's a clown who's doing it, right? So these declarations that all law is suspended and, there are no rules, this is actually what sovereignty claims for itself, right? But because carnival is self-implicating and is kind of very collective, it is saying that that's not possible, right? And it's not even possible to suspend all rules, right? He goes on, he says, The people do not exclude themselves from the wholeness of the world. They too are incomplete. They also die and are revived and renewed. This is one of the essential differences of the people's festive laughter from the pure satire of modern times. The satirist, whose laughter is negative, places himself above the object of his mockery. He is opposed to it. The wholeness of the world's comic aspect is destroyed, and that which appears comic becomes a private reaction. The people's ambivalent laughter, and I'll pause here, he's contrasting this kind of private experience of laughter that we associate with satire. We also associate this with the kind of high modern work of art, right? The sort of, you know, whether it's the painting or the piece of music or something that is meant for private, you know, absolutely like private consumption, whether it's theater, which has a fourth wall, right? So there's the spectator is not a participant in the play. Except, of course, and this is not new to performance studies at all, the spectator is part of the play, too. There wouldn't be a play if it did not have an audience, right? We wouldn't speak if we were not expecting to be heard in some way. And so what this kind of carnival, self-implicating performance is doing is it's showing these performances that kind of cast the audience as being unrelated to the actions that are being performed, or vice versa, right? Like separate the artist from the audience and clearly delineate, you know, this is just art, I don't mean it, or it has no meaning because it's on a stage. You know, stages can be very useful for kind of signaling to us as a cue that we are to suspend our disbelief and maybe permit more things, right? And one reading of that could be that, you know, the stage is a way of, you know, put the genie back in the bottle after you leave it out, right? And allow the audience to partake in whatever's happening on the stage while also not feeling like they're implicated in it. But you know, you also have to take into account that this claim is not true, right? The actors are not actually unrelated to the people who are watching it. They are actually of the society that they're performing for. And so there is an underlying collectivity that certain forms, and for Bakhtin, that's carnival, is one that he's really interested in, that certain forms, you know, kind of really thematize and highlight, and there's lots of ways of thematizing and highlighting it. You know, there's lots of, there's many different film traditions that do this in different ways, whether it's, you know, a cinema verite documentary, or different, you know, modernist films that come before that. But in this case, you know, he's saying medieval carnival is an institution where everyone is part of, like everyone's in on the joke in a certain way. And at the same time, everyone is the butt of the joke. I think you can also hear that he's a Soviet, right? By his life experience, like a citizen of the Soviet Union, he's invoking the people and he's invoking collectivity and words like utopian in ways that I think are very aware of his audience. I mean, I don't think that it's disingenuous, but I do think that he knows that, you know, utopianism has a modern resonance. It's not a term that, you know, medieval people were using, but he will nevertheless use the word utopian, I think, to kind of key this to his audience. Okay, so rather than being something like an aggressive polemic that situates the author and the speaker in opposition to, you know, to an object, basically, and kind of tries to sharpen the contradictions between the two different positions in order to make them impossible to reconcile and bring the underlying political conflict to a head. I think that the kind of speech that Bakhtin is describing in carnival humor is a lot less polemic, which I think would maybe, and somewhat ironically, because we often think of polemic as a sort of populist in its nature rather than, you know, an elite or a bourgeois form. But I think that this, that the polemical mode, which completely externalizes, you know, oneself from any kind of entanglement or implication with the position that they are critiquing, I think that that does have something in common with the high work of art that codes its audience as the viewing subject or the consuming subject or the listening subject rather than a participant in the, you know, the production itself, right? And so this subject-object metaphysics, I think, really is what carnival and, you know, carnival in the way that Bakhtin is describing is really poking fun at, right? And I think it's notable also that he describes carnival and everyday society not like they're fully at odds with each other, but I think more like they are both tones that are available to us at all times. And he, I think this comes out in a really interesting moment where he talks about clowns and fools in medieval society. He says, clowns and fools were the constant accredited representatives of the carnival spirit in everyday life out of carnival season. As such, they represented a certain form of life, which was real and ideal at the same time. They stood on the borderline between life and art, in a peculiar mid-zone, as it were. They were neither eccentrics nor dolts. Neither were they comic actors. Okay, so they were part of public life. They didn't. They weren't some, you know, external institution. Even though their whole thing was flaunting a kind of a, you know, subversive parody or a performance of what you're supposed to do, right? But you can't parody what you're supposed to do without, to some extent, acknowledging and participating in what you're supposed to do. So it's not, you know, it's not like some kind of declaration of social autonomy. Rather, I think it is calling out the fact that the mainstream institutions' claims to exclude them are false in the first place. And so they exist alongside their serious counterparts. And it's, you know, it's a little bit like that meme with Bane from Batman, you know, kind of standing with his arms up and like, you know, I guess he's supposed to be a Teletubby or something, you know, standing facing him, kind of imitating him doing the same posture, right? There's, I think, something really important about the fact that this is an imitative practice, right? And imitation is mocking, but it is also affectionate to a certain extent, right? And I think here we can bring up something like drag performance, you know, the kind of ballroom traditions that it's associated with, and that the far right is going after right now, as something of an analog in terms of what is the kind of animating logic of its relationship to mainstream institutions that disavow them. A lot of the terminology in ballroom is are transvaluations of mainstream terminology, you know, and roles, right? Whether these are gender roles that are collectively set up so that they can be experienced and enjoyed in different ways, you know, and again, right, in order to pass, like that is a social, that's a social thing, right? You need an audience to pass with, right? It's a collective production and it's a collective societal production. And so what ballroom as an institution, you know, not to describe it monolithically as just one institution, because it's very polyvocal and has times and places where it is co-opted, you know, much like Carnival, right? Being something that's contested and means a lot of different things. But the point is that it operates, you know, especially the Harlem ballroom scene of, you know, the late 1980s and early 1990s, that, you know, Paris is burning and not at all problematic. A kid, it's very problematic. Film portrays, operates in warehouses, and, you know, basically it is making use subversively of the infrastructures and institutions of a society that tells all of these participants, we don't recognize you as valuable contributors to society, because they're unemployed, right? They don't have jobs, or, you know, or if they do, they're not jobs that pay enough. Many of them don't have homes. Their experience of gender and the way that they want to relate to it is not validated. But they say, you know, like they reclaim words like work, words like houses and families that are, you know, related to houses. And they're these kind of subversive, you know, you could say parodies or imitations of these institutions. But again, this is not a parody in like a negative or nihilistic way, right? Like this is as something that you can be, and something that you can participate in a meaningful way, and that we can set up society to participate in gender in a meaningful way. So they'll reclaim words like work. They will have categories of performance that circulate, and that more are added in order to make sure that everybody at some point is able to participate, because the categories, unlike the real world where we create certain, whether it's gender roles or jobs, if we're thinking, you know, quote unquote, economically, right? But we create things, and we provision society in a particular way that we don't acknowledge to be arbitrary and exclusionary. And then when people don't fit into that, we blame them for it. And so this is like a communal parody of the labor market. Whether it's the fashion industry with its categories and the way that the fashion industry participates in the public provisioning of gender. This is a, yes, humorous performance, but it's not a kind of a negative humor that is declaring that actually, you know, people who participate in ballroom aren't part of the regular society. It's saying, no, they are part of the regular society. And the regular society is actually really campy and really gay and doesn't even acknowledge that. And so it's kind of a logic of calling in and performing subversively alongside and kind of forcing a dialogue that the other side, quote unquote, the other side, wants to disavow as even being possible. So I just want to flag that this is, I think, a similar logic to how I think Carnival is, in the way that Bakhtin writes about it, is relating to, you know, so-called official institutions, official ceremonies and official, you know, the crowning of kings and the, you know, who gets to be a knight, and religious ceremonies where you have clearly delineated, you know, hierarchies within the church, right? Carnival exists in and among those institutions variously, and this is really a question for historians, i.e. not me, but, you know, variously, I'm sure, in tension with those institutions, sometimes not intentioned so much, you know, again, returning to what I said before about the fact that you can't judge any art form or performance or anything like that as if it has intrinsic qualities, right? And not viewing those, whatever you observe to be its qualities and its social meanings, as being collective social productions, which I think is actually always the case. So I've talked a little bit about carnival humor right now. I want to also talk especially about the kind of physical aspect of the carnival humor. And I think in that last quote where I was talking about clowns and fools being real and ideal at the same time, I think here is another case where Bakhtin is articulating something that is playing a little bit with what are the, in the Soviet Union, delineation between the real and the ideal, right? And he's doing so in a way that I think is something of a carnival inversion, right? So he's saying clowns and fools are real and ideal at the same time, right? So what's real about them? Well, what's real about them is that they're not behind a stage, right? They're not, this is not a performance that is meant to be not real, quote unquote, right? Like we see clowns and fools in, you know, we, the medieval people, we see clowns and fools not as being, you know, fully ideal and having nothing to do with us, but as being among us, right? But at the same time, they represent something that is ideal, which is art, right? What he says is they stand on the borderline between life and art. And art is this area of possibility, right? Of imagination, of things that are possible and are possible not just in ways that are intrinsic to some kind of clear set of, you know, the material conditions in this society, because you can't clearly delineate what is in this society. And often conditions of possibility depend on things that are external to what you're talking about. And, you know, you unravel and you deconstruct this, and, you know, you can't really pin down what is possible, because it's a polyvocal world of polyvocal causality, and things, you know, change and co-determine, and even that word determine I would want to push back against a little bit, right? Because I don't think that anything is determined as, you know, as like this is determined to, because again, clowns and fools, right? They're real and ideal at the same time. They're determined and undetermined at the same time. And so this simultaneity of real and ideal is going to be the basis then of something of what I think is maybe a kind of carnival inversion of this binary opposition in the first place, where on the one hand he's going to say he's opposed to the material here and now abstracted from its utopian potential, which is the fact that there's a realm of ideals that exists here, right? But he's going to say that in that abstracting it from these possibilities is actually an act of idealism, right? But it's a one-sided idealism. And his point then, what he gets at, is that actually materiality in what he calls grotesque realism, and I'll read his kind of description of that in a second, but materiality in grotesque realism, what is grotesque about it is that it refuses to be contained in a here and now, in an objective delineation of subject and object, or even a contradictory, as in internally contradictory and embattled subject and object, as in the capitalist mode of production, right? Being an internally contradictory, but nevertheless, in some sense, right, determined mode of production. He's going to say that this kind of idealistic contraction of everything to an immediate here and now, where ideas can't help you because they're far away and all that exists right now is just power, right? And in a situation of power and of conflict between two forces, right, like the sublime, for example, or dialectics, or, you know, any of these Renaissance and later Baroque staged encounters between the self and the other that have to be synthesized as a quantitative measurement of power and force, right? That all of these, yes, in Renaissance and in modern art, that's what materiality is. In the medieval carnival humor and the way that degradation is played with in this humor, and then also in the writings of Rabelais, his images, which have this kind of, you know, like they're, again, right, they're grotesque. There are limbs that are becoming huge and falling off, and bellies that stick out, and, you know, like all kinds of, like, what I guess you might call body horror or something like that. But it's not horror, it's humor. And it's humor that is actually very, very material, and material in a way that is sacred, because in the material world, quote unquote, everything is actually caught up in that double existence as both real and ideal. That is, as the way that things are, quote unquote, but then also that's not true, right? There are multiple ways that things are right now. And the way that things are, even just stating that, is an abstraction that is one-sided. So it's this simultaneity of the real and the ideal, which is in the kind of Bolshevik and Stalinist discourses that he's kind of critiquing. The real and the ideal are, you know, I mean, that's like base superstructure, basically, right? And I think that this resonates with the way that people draw a line between real organizing and online, right, and posting, or class politics and identity politics, or class versus culture. And the point is not that culture is, you know, what constitutes class, but that class isn't identical to itself in the first place, because the world is not identically everybody playing one role in this big fucked up machine, right? That the machine is actually not a machine. And so here's what he says about Rabelais' images. He says, Rabelais' images have a certain undestroyable non-official nature. No dogma, no authoritarianism, no narrow-minded seriousness can coexist with Rabelaisian images. These images are opposed to all that is finished and polished, to all pomposity, to every ready-made solution in the sphere of thought and world outlook. And so he's going to say that this is why romantic, you know, writers in the romantic period don't really seem to get what's going on with grotesque images in Rabelais, and they either just see it as kind of a nihilistic, you know, vulgarity, or else that basically they would formulate as horror. But he's going to insist that no, this is laughter, and it's a self-implicating laughter. It's self-implicating in the fact that none of us are identical to ourselves. And we may think that we have these beautiful finished forms, but in fact, we all get old, right? We all, you know, our bodies change and we all die. And as we all die, the world, you know, other people are born too, right? And the actions that we've had, they don't just go away once we're dead, right? Nor do they have just one single legacy. There's a kind of a deep historical sense of time in Bakhtin that is not linear and is not univocal, and I think is much more like, you know, something we say, oh, that didn't age well. But that could either be interpreted as an intrinsic statement about, you know, oh, that wasn't as good as we thought it was, Or it could be, wow, a bunch of things really happened, and now this means something else. And I think, and it can be both, right? It's not either or. But it's that kind of persistent relativity that there's no outside of that Bakhtin is really interested in. And for him, he's actually going to align with this grotesque realism as an aesthetic. So now I'm going to read a little bit on how he describes Rabelais' grotesque realism. He says, it is usually pointed out that in Rabelais' work, the material bodily principle, that is, images of the human body with its food, drink, defecation, and sexual life, plays a predominant role. Images of the body are offered, moreover, in an extremely exaggerated form. Rabelais was proclaimed by Victor Hugo the greatest poet of the flesh and belly, while others accused him of gross physiologism, of biologism, or naturalism. Similar traits were also found to a lesser degree in other representatives of Renaissance literature, in Boccaccio, Shakespeare, and Cervantes, and were interpreted as a rehabilitation of the flesh, characteristic of the Renaissance in reaction against the ascetic Middle Ages, right? And here, asceticism, that is a kind of a poverty of experience, right, is being aligned with idealism because it's imagined that there is some kind of a zero-sum trade-off, right? Instead of experiencing worldly pleasures, you're stuck in your mind. And, of course, there's a, again, right, this doesn't really, like, that kind of a zero-sum binary between real and ideal doesn't really go with the medieval carnival, or with the fool, right? Like, there is both a here-and-now physical pleasure of these kind of, you know, ridiculous carnival performances or the fool or whatever. But then also it is, you know, it's very cerebral, right? It is, there's something idealistic about it. It is about imagination. So he says, sometimes these images were seen as a typical manifestation of the Renaissance bourgeois character. That is, of its material interest in, quote, economic man. But, he says, all these and similar explanations are nothing but interpretations according to the narrow and modified meaning which modern ideology, especially that of the 19th century, attributed to materiality and to the body. Actually, the images of the material bodily principle in the work of Rabelais and of other writers of the Renaissance are the heritage, only somewhat modified by the Renaissance, of the culture of folk humor, that is, the carnival humor. They're the heritage of that peculiar type of imagery, and more broadly speaking, of that peculiar aesthetic concept, which is characteristic of this folk culture, and which differs sharply from the aesthetic concept of the following ages. We shall call it conditionally the concept of grotesque realism. The material bodily principle in grotesque realism is offered in its all-popular festive and utopian aspect. The cosmic, social, and bodily elements here are given as an indivisible whole, and this whole is gay and gracious. Okay, so this is a different take on what the body is, right? The body is not a sensuous experience that is at odds with the ideal, but it is in fact constitutively ideal. And the reason it's constitutively ideal is because it's festive, right? It is changing, it's becoming, it's not identical to itself. If you were to ask, you know, what kind of body type do you have? There's not one answer to that question over the course of your life, or even over the course of a year, right? Or a month. We change, right? And we change constantly, and we change socially as well. And so he says, in grotesque realism, therefore, the bodily element is deeply positive. It is presented not in a private, egotistic form, severed from the other spheres of life, but as something universal, representing all the people. right? So again, the body here is not this contracted aesthetic that is my private enjoyment where I can get all the experience for myself, right? Actually, the outside and other people are constitutive of the experience and even are constitutive of the body, right? And of the humor, of the body being degraded and dying and being born, and the, you know, we eat and we have sex and we defecate and we give birth and we do all of these different things that are constantly changing, and yet that change is actually what is the continuity. It's continuous in the sense that none of us are exempt from, you know, this kind of ridiculous hole that where no official authoritarian declarations or dogmas apply ever. But because of that, we also can't be fully externalized. And so it's not a declaration. Again, it's not a retreat into individual localized experience, right? It's actually a way of saying that even what has been cast out of society as local and as individual, whether we want to give that, you know, anarchist or communal, like commune trappings, or we want to say it's, you know, Jeffrey Epstein on his island being a billionaire, being able to do whatever he wants, right? None of these are actually outside of the society, whether or not they want to be outside of the society, whether or not the society wants them to be outside of the society, whatever the hell we even mean by the society, right? He's saying that, like, that is what is this cosmic whole. Form is underwritten by change, and in some sense, if not a formlessness, like a multiplicity of forms. So he says, we repeat, the body and bodily life have here a cosmic and at the same time in all people's character. This is not the body and its physiology in the modern sense of these words, because it is not individualized. The material bodily principle is contained not in the biological individual, not in the bourgeois ego, but in the people, a people who are continually growing and renewed. This is why all that is bodily becomes grandiose, exaggerated, and immeasurable. Okay, and again, immeasurable is really key here, because a lot of the time when we talk about materiality and we try to imagine the absence of authoritarianism, we're doing so on the terms of authoritarianism, right? And what does authoritarianism say? It says that basically in the beginning there was the word, right? The authoritarian, the law was set down, and now things are this way. Or it's set down and it's contested, right? But the point is that life is a play of force. And so if you take that away, then you're imagining just a pure negativity, which is a certain kind of physics, right? And a certain kind of force and quantification and measurement that reasserts itself again, only it is kind of self-exculpating because we think of it as being natural, because it's the absence of law and the absence of declarations, right? So it's just the law of the jungle, and oops, we're back in authoritarianism, right? Again, this is why Giorgio Agamben ends up being an eco-fascist. He says, this exaggeration has a positive, assertive character. The leading themes of these images of bodily life are fertility, growth, and a brimming over abundance. Manifestations of this life refer not to the isolated biological individual, not to the private, egotistic, economic man, but to the collective ancestral body of all the people. Abundance and the all people's element also determine the gay and festive character of all images of bodily life. They do not reflect the drabness of everyday existence. The material bodily principle is a triumphant festive principle. Okay, so the material and the bodily here is against everyday existence. So this is that carnival inversion, right, of ideal and material, where he's actually saying that, no, the material, which is really festive and utopian, is what's real, and what is ideal is this one-sided imagination of a here and now where everything is clearly defined, and here are the clearly defined conditions of possibility. Here's how much political power is located here, and therefore the working class needs to do this, right? He's critiquing Stalinism here. But not just Stalinism itself. He's implicating Stalinism in a longer history of, Western modernity. And the Enlightenment and Renaissance humanism and then the Baroque, right? And Romanticism. And he's not saying that any of these things are univocal, or that they cannot be read other ways, right? I mean, I think he himself is a very good example of this. One, he's a literary figure, and literature is a private, form of enjoyment. But he writes about the carnival spirit being imbued in literary novels. And I'll talk about this another time. But he really is interested in how you can also find these kind of philosophical insights in an interior way. Carnival, these are exterior rituals and expressions of them, but there are also ways where our own interior aesthetic experiences aren't identical to themselves. It's not just, me as the listener or as the consumer getting a pure, unmediated aesthetic experience, but actually this practice of being a listener and of being a connoisseur and an appreciator of art is also social. And is also polyvocal, and there's all kinds of ways where he's actually really interested in the novel as a particular historical form, right? Like the novel, as something that can really explore that internal constitutive multi-voicedness of ourselves. But then this is also complicated, right? Because he is in the Soviet Union. Yes, he is something of a political dissident, but it's not like he's outside of the culture. And they didn't, he was going to get sent to a gulag, but they didn't send him to one because of his health problems. He ended up at a bookstore in Kazakhstan and then was able to go back to university in the Soviet Union in the 1940s. He is a very good example, I think, of the polyvocality of a society and of an epoch, right? That somebody like him can exist and can exist in dialogue with powers that be that, that ignore him, right? And so I don't want this to sound like it's just a univocal denunciation of modernity as if that's some kind of a univocal whole, because his whole point is that there are many different strands that you can trace across any period of historical time. But in this case, there's this kind of grotesque naturalism and grotesque realism that is a tradition that presents materiality in the body not as immediacy, because it would say that immediacy is an idealistic abstraction, right? There's no such thing as immediacy. Everything is changing together all the time. And at scales that are wider than the powers that be permit. So he says, "The complex nature of Renaissance realism has not as yet been sufficiently disclosed. Two types of imagery reflecting the conception of the world here meet at a crossroads. One of them ascends to the folk culture of humor, while the other is the bourgeois conception of the completed atomized being," right? So these are two different aesthetic traditions that exist in the same time. He says, "The conflict of these two contradictory trends in the interpretation of the bodily principle is typical of Renaissance realism. The ever-growing, inexhaustible, ever-laughing principle, which uncrowns and renews, is combined with its opposite, the petty, inert, quote, material principle of class society. So again, right, he's putting material principle here of class society in quotes, because, like, I don't think he's taking that at face value. You know, it's, yes, that is an ideology that is important to understand, and that influences how these institutions tend to work, but it's not their horizon of what they even are. And I think, you know, that's why he's interested in Carnival, right? So he says, the flowering of grotesque realism is a system of images created by the medieval culture of folk humor, and its summit is the literature of the Renaissance. At that time, the term grotesque first appears on the scene, but in a narrow sense, occasioned by the finding at the end of the 15th century of a certain type of Roman ornament previously unknown. These ornaments were brought to light during the excavation of Titus's baths and were called grotesca, from the Italian word grotta. Somewhat later, similar ornaments were discovered in other areas of Italy. What is the character of these ornaments? They impressed the connoisseurs by the extremely fanciful, free, and playful treatment of plant, animal, and human forms. These forms seemed to be interwoven, as if giving birth to each other. And this is going to be very different from Renaissance painting, where forms are very clearly individuated from each other and clearly defined. And in fact, that individuation is, you know, think back to, you know, think of the creation of Adam, right? Like Michelangelo's painting in the Sistine Ceiling. You have God and Adam very clearly defined as separate and distinct from each other. And this is sad, right? Because the fact that they're separate and distinct from each other means that they can't be together, that they can't touch, right? And that's the essence of creation in this view, right? You have God and Adam reaching to touch each other, reaching to be the same being, and they can't. And so there's an angst, there's an anxiety, there's a trauma, right? There's a sensation of falling and of being subject to physics and subject to power that's scary. And I'll talk a little bit about fear, which is another thing that Bakhtin is really interested in as something that distinguishes kind of romantic takes on the grotesque from this Renaissance version of the grotesque that emphasizes humor rather than fear. So he says, the borderlines of these ornaments that divide the kingdoms of nature in the usual picture of the world were boldly infringed. Neither was there the usual static presentation of reality. There was no longer the movement of finished forms, vegetable or animal, in a finished and stable world. Instead, the inner movement of being itself was expressed in the passing of one form into the other, in the ever-incompleted character of being. This ornamental interplay revealed an extreme lightness and freedom of artistic fantasy, a gay, almost laughing libertinage. The gay tone of the new ornament was grasped and brilliantly rendered by Raphael and his pupils in their grotesque decoration of the Vatican loggias. And I love that you have these Renaissance artists like Raphael, who we associate with finished forms and, you know, these trademarks of Florentine humanism, at the same time and even in the same building, working in this other tradition of formlessness, right? And again, I think that this speaks in a way, I mean, it speaks to, you know, Carnival existing alongside traditional society. I've also suggested it, you know, it speaks to ballroom existing alongside institutions of provisioning gender and jobs and all of these things in very normative and exclusionary ways, of Athenian comedy and tragedy existing next to each other. I hazard a guess you could find a lot of different examples of humor and of, you know, what are Bakhtin's insights here, right? Like a kind of a humorous realization of formlessness, not as, oh no, I'm losing who I am, I'm dying, but as a kind of a funny realization, right? That what is scary and different, it turns out, is not so scary and different. And we get there by exaggerating it. And so this is very, you know, this is laughter defeating fear, which he's really interested in. And I'll talk about that in a sec, a little bit more, because I have some really good quotes about that. But I also want to make a comment here on a few different things in this quote. One of them is the fact that these are ornaments, I find to be really interesting. So we have this Renaissance style of painting on the one hand, you know, this kind of flat medium and Renaissance perspective imitating a kind of an indexicality and a that is an indexical relation to the world, like, you know, the way that reality imprints itself on our eyeballs, you know, very realistically. We have, you know, perfect geometric perspective and a vanishing point and all of these things that we associate with Renaissance perspective, versus ornaments, right? And ornaments, you kind of think of as sort of rising up from a flat surface in an almost unnatural way, right? Like even the physical form of this versus a painted image, there is something extra about ornaments. There's also something, I think, maybe gendered about ornaments as well, and ornamentation. You know, we think of ornateness as well, right, as being kind of superfluous and unnecessary, and maybe for that reason a little bit grotesque. But in this tradition of grotesque realism, we can think of, you know, people outgrowing their own bodies in this kind of ridiculous way, people overflowing by giving birth, by defecating, urinating, you know, eating things, you know, dying, right? Like all these ways that our forms themselves are constantly being violated, even though and violating themselves, even though we individuate ourselves, right? It's this realization that individuation is a kind of an idealist practice in some ways, or at least it's not the last word on what we are, or even the only word on what we are at any point. So I want to talk about ornaments, both making that observation that, you know, ornaments, you think of them as kind of physically coming up and being a little bit excessive and a little bit grotesque in this way. But also because, you know, around the same time, you know, maybe within a decade of when this was written, I believe in the late 1930s, about a decade before that, Siegfried Krakauer, a fellow traveler of the Frankfurt School and somebody in the kind of Marxist aesthetic tradition, he writes an essay called The Mass Ornament. And the ornament for him is this symbol of a kind of a creative myth making, right? That humanity does, that we as people participate in, but that has this kind of there's an irrational core of it. But he is noting the rationalization of society to that irrational core without acknowledging that it's an irrational core. And so he's looking especially at a group of dancers, you know, kind of like Busby Berkeley musicals in the United States, called the Tiller Girls. And the Tiller Girls have these like highly synchronized geometric patterns, where his whole point and what he's noticing about this is that if you were to look at any of these individual dancers, none of them are really dancing. They, like, all of their actions are just predicated on the geometric shape of the whole, right? And there seems to be almost a zero-sum trade-off between real dancing and this kind of rationalization of dancing and reduction of human movement to serve a whole. And he's gonna, you know, be comparing that first. He's gonna compare it to, you know, capitalism and the kind of rationalization of labor into assembly lines and things like that, where, you know, we go into the market with our labor and we sell it in order to do these very degraded tasks, like, you know, push a button over and over again, the kind of thing that Marx also railed against, obviously. But Krakauer's more interesting, I think, because he also is not, you know, like, yes, he's concerned with this mass ornament, and he's gonna, after comparing it to capitalism, he's gonna also see it after the 1930s as something of a harbinger of fascism, right? Which is the ultimate rationalization of human life towards an irrational industrial objective, which was basically genocide, right? In that instance, and I think it's really interesting that he calls this the mass ornament, this kind of big collectivity that we are all subordinated to. And I think it's no accident that he's appealing to, like, I don't think it's an accident that it's an ornament, because the ornaments here, yeah, they have something to do with this grotesque excess. And Krakauer would love to have a kind of a myth making that is not happening on these terms. He's pessimistic, though, and he can't, you know, like, he kind of only really negatively articulates these hopes. And, you know, my colleagues Scott Ferguson and Max Seho have a really good reading on the mass ornament in a Superstructure episode that they did called Marx Was Right. And yeah, so I recommend listeners listen to that. But I just want to flag that that this term ornament, I think, is really interesting because there is a kind of a connection between ornament and abstraction and myth making and the grotesque. And Marx uses the word grotesque also. I mean, it's very well known. Marx is very interested in Gothic imagery, where grotesque is a symbol of excess and things outgrowing themselves. But he doesn't see this as natural, right? He sees this as unnatural, and grotesque for him is a very negative term. You know, this is not the Rabelaisian image of the grotesque body that is universal because it's grotesque, and that is funny, and funny in a way that is self-implicating and universal, and kind of makes us realize, you know, that we all are kind of participating in what he calls the inner movement of being, right? By changing, by dying, by being born, etc. Marx is going to, there are all kinds of passages where he describes capital as being grotesque, but I want to read one in particular where he actually uses the word grotesque. He's comparing, you know, he's saying on the one hand, you can have a form of wood that gets altered if a table is made out of it. But nevertheless, the table continues to be wood, right? It's an ordinary sensuous thing. But as soon as it emerges as a commodity, it changes into a thing which transcends sensuousness. It not only stands with its feet on the ground, but in relation to all other commodities, it stands on its head and evolves out of its wooden brain grotesque ideas far more wonderful than if it were to begin dancing on its own free will, right? So this is the grotesque being aligned with this trade-off, right, between an ideal and a real, where rather than in this, ironically, what Bakhtin would say is a bourgeois individualistic form of enjoyment, which I think Marx wants to affirm, but he wants it to be for everyone, right? We should all be able to live like the bourgeoisie does. Whereas Bakhtin is saying, no, you can't just define what is a good life by pure negative freedom to do whatever you want, because the things that we do are social. And the grotesque and the ornamental, in this Marxist tradition, which is about a dialectic between the aesthetic sphere of individual sensuous experience and a sphere of abstraction and commerce and economics. And for Krakauer later, right, this is authoritarianism too. These are in a zero-sum dialectical conflict with each other, where we can have an aesthetic project, but it's going to be impoverished because the means by which society is provisioned, quote-unquote, under capitalism, exist in a zero-sum relation to the aesthetic sphere. And this is why, you know, we at Money on the Left are so interested in this question of whether or not money is grotesque as an alien evil form that is synonymous with commerce and exchange and the bourgeoisie, or whether it is overdetermined by its own, whether it's legal or social or linguistic constructions, and constructions that we can participate in subversively too. And so we talk a lot about other monetary traditions, such as complementary currencies. One way of viewing and reading a complementary currency is as some kind of a like fully external thing, right? Like we're going to create an economy that is outside of the economy. But that is taking sovereignty at its word, that it alone determines what are its insides and outsides. But it's not acknowledging that the world is already coordinated beyond what any one currency claims, right? And so when you make a complementary currency, what you're doing is you are helping the dollar coordinate society. You're not outside of society because you're making a complementary currency. And not only that, but there are possibilities. You know, as I record this, we just saw the Silicon Valley Bank get a huge bailout, right? This bank that didn't have dollar receivability necessarily for all of its uninsured deposits that became worthless once bonds became more valuable than its own deposits. Suddenly there's a bank run, and essentially they got dollar receivability for their deposits like overnight. And of course they did because they're rich and powerful, right? But the point though is that there are all kinds of moments. I mean, certainly the response to COVID was a very multi-layered response, and things like stimulus checks did happen. And were they enough? Absolutely not. They should be expanded. Social distancing in a way that is abundantly funded, you know, in ways that doesn't artificially pit social distancing, right, against a rich social life. Because, you know, the fact that social distancing is this like lonely thing is, you know, in part it's because we don't have good institutions, right? Like good institutions for relating to each other at a distance. Don't get me wrong, we have institutions for relating to each other at a distance. We have Twitter, we have Facebook, we have social media companies that suck. We have podcasts, which are not all bad. You're listening to one right now. But, you know, these are happening in spite of the fact that they are largely unfunded. That doesn't have to be the case. And often during times of crisis, something like a complementary currency can make the case for getting recognition and like, you know, exchangeability by institutions that issue more official currencies. But the point is that they always exist alongside and as part of the same society as the, you know, as the official or state currency. States can always issue swap lines, and in fact always do have swap lines. There are lots of different kinds of monies that are exchanging at par because of institutions that make them exchange at par, right? There's not just the dollar. There's the cash in your pocket. There's bonds and securities. There's reserve balances. There's, you know, bank deposits. There's all kinds of different versions of the dollar. There's Starbucks gift cards, right? There's all kinds of different versions of the dollar. And then the stuff of politics is whose dollars get accepted in the places that they need to be accepted in a time of an emergency. And so creating these complementary currencies, I think, is constitutive of building that political power to gain acceptance and widen the sphere of acceptance and legibility by building it as you go along with these localized experiments that are not happening fully outside the system. In the same way, I think that this is in large part how drag and ballroom has negotiated, you could say, receivability and exchangeability with mainstream cultural institutions, right? That now you have a lot of people, and it's messy and it's contested, and I'm not here to adjudicate, you know, anything, but you have a lot of people who are, you know, on the one hand living very, you know, quote unquote straight or normative lives who identify themselves as queer. And I think that is because institutions like drag performance, like queer media, there are long traditions of queer media, form connections of intimacy and receivability in ways that then build power, quote unquote. And I say quote unquote because I don't think that power is intrinsic to a group. I think that power, again, right, it has to do with legibility and receivability, and that's really what you're trying to build. And that is a very messy and nonlinear process, and it's a process that is a semantic process. And so I think that when we at Money on the Left say money is queer, that's what we mean. We don't mean that capitalism is good. We mean that money is not capitalism. We don't mean that the state is good. We mean that money is not the state. It can be all of these things, but it is also more than those things, right? It is real and ideal at the same time, in that kind of Bakhtinian way. It's polyvocal. And so now I want to move on, lastly, to what he has to say about laughter and fear, because I think that this is really important, and that kind of Renaissance Florentine humanism turning into, you know, Baroque and Romantic genres, that particular thread is going to give us the sublime and the sublime encounter. That is an encounter with something external to oneself that is so vast that basically it overwhelms and scares you. The sublime is supposed to be terrifying, and the idea is that there's some kind of purifying experience of being terrified, which, not to say that this is all that the sublime can be and that people can't get lots of different things from the sublime, but I think that formulation is very problematic. And here's what he says. It was the victory of laughter over fear that most impressed medieval man. It was not only a victory over mystic terror of God, but also a victory over the awe inspired by the forces of nature, right? So again, right, the awe inspired by the forces of nature, that's the sublime. And that word force, I think, is really key here, because force is not co-determined by many things, right? Force is force. It's intrinsic to force. He's saying that force, the idea of force, is just a kind of a homogenizing, and like it's an idea, right? It's a form of sort of simplification and reduction and myth making. And in fact, the world doesn't move through force. It moves through, right, A, B, C, and D coming together in, you know, to, you know, for events to unfold in a certain way. Not A causes B, right? As if in a vacuum and hermetically sealed. Right. But that's what force, that's what the idea of force communicates. And it's what the reduction of politics to force, like it's the way that it trains us to think. And that's why when Marx talks about the dialectic, he uses words like sobriety and, you know, you need to come, the working class needs to come to its senses and soberly realize the situation that it's in, right? There's this kind of reduction that has to happen where you need to let go of all the fanciful ideas and multiplicity and see how things really are. Because once you see how things really are and have that sublime experience, that sublime encounter with your real condition, then it will become clear, right, what you're supposed to do. And what Bakhtin is articulating here is something much more mysterious than that. You know, this is not a picture becoming more clear, right? It's actually a picture becoming less clear. So it's not realization. It's more like revelation, I think. So he says, so it's also a victory over the awe inspired by the forces of nature, and most of all, over the oppression and guilt related to all that was consecrated and forbidden, mana and taboo. It was the defeat of divine and human power, right? So the defeat of power itself, divine or human, of authoritarian commandments and prohibitions, of death and punishment after death, hell and all that is more terrifying than the earth itself, right? And again, this idea of what's terrifying and what's more terrifying, right? Like that idea of magnitude, of measurable power, that's what the sublime is all about. And that's what comes out of this reduction that you get in Florentine humanism and in, you know, the in other Money on the Left content. We have talked about the Franciscan tradition, which is a whole other thing that I'm not going to get into. But, you know, the kind of there is a metaphysics that's associated with modernity that is a reduction of everything to immediacy and the immediate and therefore unreliable and careless comings and goings of finite things, right? And that's why in the creation of Adam, they're reaching towards each other and it's tragic, right? Like this is the fall. The fall is that they can't actually touch each other and be the same being. Once Adam individuates from God, he's on his own. Whereas what's being articulated here as medieval laughter is the realization that the fact that Adam and God are not the same entity, and that being this grotesque body horror, right? Think of like an amoeba dividing into two or something like that. That actually is going to return us to universality. And actually here I want to take a quick break just to talk about degradation and the kind of, how kind of disgusting and debasing it is to lose your form, right? Which is what these carnivalesque inversions do, right? It's like, you know, the humiliation of losing your rank or your status or something in the carnival. There are all these rituals of degradation and debasement in carnival that have a life-affirming quality that is not at all about fear. And Bakhtin writes about that in particular here. He says, degradation and debasement of the higher do not have a formal and relative character in grotesque realism. Upward and downward here have an absolute and strictly topographical meaning. Downward is earth. Upward is heaven. Earth is an element that devours, swallows up, think the grave or the womb, and at the same time, right, not separate as the creation of Adam is God needs to leave in order to create Adam. Here, these are simultaneous. At the same time, an element of birth, of renaissance, think the maternal breasts. Such is the meaning of upward and downward in their cosmic aspect, while in their purely bodily aspect, which is not clearly distinct from the cosmic, the upper part is the face or the head, and the lower part is the genital organs, the belly, and the buttocks. These absolute topographical connotations are used by grotesque realism, including medieval parody. Degradation here means coming down to earth, the contact with earth as an element that swallows up and gives birth at the same time. To degrade is to bury, to sow, and to kill simultaneously, in order to bring forth something more and better. To degrade also means to concern oneself with the lower stratum of the body, the life of the belly, and the reproductive organs. It therefore relates to acts of defecation and copulation, conception, pregnancy, and birth. Degradation digs a bodily grave for a new birth. It has not only a destructive negative aspect, but also a regenerating one. To degrade an object does not imply merely hurling it into the void of non-existence, into absolute destruction, but to hurl it down to the reproductive lower stratum, the zone in which conception and a new birth take place. Grotesque realism knows no other lower level. It is the fruitful earth and the womb. It is always conceiving, right? And here, I think we can think of the grotesque and later theories of abjection, like Julia Kristeva. What is abject is what we don't want to be. But here, if we look at this in the kind of social way, that the way that what is very, very material and bodily is material and bodily because it is social, we can think of something like unemployment, right? Which is abject, you know, according to the dollar, right? But you think of drag or ballroom, or, you know, queerness, which is abject in relation to straightness. These are productive places, right? To be queer is not to be hurled, as he would say, to be hurled into the void of non-existence or absolute destruction. It is to be hurled into the reproductive stratum, the zone where life is conceiving. And so grotesque realism knows no other lower level, he says. It's the fruitful earth in the womb, and it's always conceiving, right? So this is not a moment after death where then death has created a clearing or a space for birth. It's the fact that it's always both at once. And this, he says, is the reason why medieval parody is unique, quite unlike the purely formalist literary parody of modern times, which has a solely negative character and is deprived of regenerating ambivalence, right? So the solely negative character here, whether it's a parody that is very mean-spirited, whether this is like a polemic that is degrading, that's picking something and just degrading it and saying it's the enemy, and othering it and, you know, just and only getting shit on that one thing. This is a parody that is self-implicating, right? That is degrading in the sense that, like, it's degrading to all parties, and degrading in a way that is going to be associated with the kind of a regeneration here. So going back to the quote I was talking about before, about fear and laughter, he continues, through this victory, laughter clarified man's consciousness. That is a victory over death, right? And punishment and prohibition and all of that. Through this victory, laughter clarified man's consciousness and gave him a new outlook on life. This truth was ephemeral, right? So it being ephemeral, right? This is not a positive truth. This is what you could call an apathetic truth, right? Or a negative truth, a truth that is, you know, sort of a knowing what you don't know, right? Like, it's not positing a way that things are. This is a truth that is the truth of ephemerality, right? The truth of multiple truths. So this truth was ephemeral. It was followed by the fears and oppressions of everyday life. But from those brief moments, another unofficial truth emerged. Truth about the world and man, which prepared the new Renaissance consciousness. Okay, and later he says, however, medieval laughter is not a subjective, individual, and biological consciousness of the uninterrupted flow of time. Okay, so this is not just awareness of change. It's the social consciousness of all the people. Man experiences this flow of time in the festive marketplace, in the carnival crowd. Okay, and when we say marketplace here, we're thinking medieval. So a market is much more like carnival, you know, a set date. This is not like the free market or something. It says, man experiences this flow of time in the festive marketplace, in the carnival crowd, as he comes into contact with other bodies of varying age and social caste. He is aware of being a member of a continually growing and renewed people. This is why festive folk laughter presents an element of victory, not only over supernatural awe, over the sacred, over death, it also means the defeat of power, of earthly kings, of the earthly upper classes, of all that oppresses and restricts. Medieval laughter, when it triumphed over the fear inspired by the mystery of the world and by power, boldly unveiled the truth about both. Let me say that again. Medieval power, when it triumphed over the fear inspired by the mystery of the world and by power. Okay, so when laughter triumphs over that initial trauma response that we have to mystery, right, and to power, which is we read it as force with its own intrinsic laws of motion, rather than as something that's co-determined by a whole world, right, that might still give us reason to be, you know, scared relatively, but it doesn't have an absolute, like, there's no absolute power, even in one moment, even if we historicize it, there's no absolute power. Right, he says, medieval laughter resisted praise, flattery, and hypocrisy. This laughing truth, expressed in curses and abusive words, degraded power. The medieval clown was also the herald of this truth, right? And again, when we think about the medieval clown, he's talking about an institution that exists year-round, okay? An institution that is related to carnival, which is only seasonal, but the clown as an institution is always a social presence. And I think that that is a good figure for any, right? We have a Pride Month, right? Which is a month, supposedly, you know, where everything is supposed to be a little bit more queer, but queer people live always, right? And I think that this is a similar thing here. And now I want to come to a close here. I'm going to continue with Bakhtin in future episodes and make this a series, but I want to close on what I think is a really important thought here on laughter that he has, which is he says that laughter liberates not only from external censorship, that is, not only from external power, but first of all, from the great interior censor. And I think that this is important politically in Bakhtin's context, because he's talking about living in a political context where he is relating dialogically, as he would say, as dialogue, and that will be the topic of another episode. He's relating to others in his society as people that he's politically relating to, not violently relating to, but politically relating to them, but not in a clear inside or outside way, as the doctrines of Stalinism and Marxism-Leninism require you to do, right? And I think that this speaks today to the way that people think about the left, right? As though that is this clearly demarcated of people distinct from quote-unquote liberals or distinct from normies or distinct from the regular people who are variously put on a pedestal, like these are the mysterious regular people that we the left have to relate to somehow, or get so completely othered, you know, anything that exists under capitalism, it positions the left as being outside of that in an absolute way, which means that the left is absolutely outside of power, which means that the left absolutely has to distinguish itself from whether it's, you know, AOC and the squad, or it's, you know, or it's Jon Stewart or Elizabeth Warren or, you know, progressives, or it's institutions that we want to read in univocal ways in order to reduce the world to the polarity of American power versus non-American power, where non-American power must be good because American power is bad, right? Which is not to apologize for any of the things that American power usually refers to, which are bad, right? But also you know, American power is the post office and universities and, you know, and I mean, I'm an American, right? Like there are all kinds of ways where institutions that exist, quote unquote, under capitalism or under empire are not identical to empire and are also not absolutely external from the society, right? Like I think that just as Carnival is not completely external to medieval society, we need to not think in terms of demarcation and not in terms of clearly defining who is we in the first place, because I think that that tends to lean towards a kind of an atomizing, a very impoverished idea of what all of these kinds of politics are, right? Which is to reduce and figure out in a narrow way what is to be done and other and externalize the people who are online or not real or not legitimate. And I see this as relating in very patterned ways to a lot of historical exclusions, but also just missing the point of how change happens and develops. Queer people are being attacked right now, but I don't think that we should reduce them to, in their queerness, they're victims, and in their class identity, they're powerful. I don't think that there's such a trade-off. I think that actually a lot of the way that queer, and not absolute assimilation either, but like the queering of society has unfolded is through institutions that reflexively implicate themselves in parodies of the official institutions that exclude them. And I think that that's a form of politics and political speech that is always available to us and is always much further and beyond any simple univocal answer of what is to be done. And I don't think that that entails just a relativizing and a flattening of everything into, well, it doesn't matter what you do. Part of the gambit with Money on the Left is that there's not just one answer to the question of what is to be done. But the reason for that is because we can make and unlock lots of answers and make these answers speak to each other. And I think that money is a very good analogy for how to do that, right? You defamiliarize it from its commercial meaning and you discover that it is in fact public, but you also defamiliarize it from its associations with sovereignty and realize that sovereignty isn't even identical to its claims, and that and a swap line can be made between any two currencies, and the explanation for how that happens historically is not intrinsic to what happens inside the nation state, right? It's also things, you know, that are quote-unquote external to the nation state that are, of course, not external because there are no absolute externalities. And this is why there will always be a carnival impulse. There will always be ways of non-identically relating to the world and subverting it that are also loving and also playful and, you know, playful in being non-identical. And playful in being aggressive, right? So thank you all so much for listening to this. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of what I've been thinking about the past year. And it's, I think, just the beginning of this series. I want to also talk about some of what Bakhtin has to say about speech and polyvocality. And he has a whole bunch of terms because he's doing all this stuff before a lot of, you know, what gets called postmodernism and poststructuralism, but which has actually a lot in common with it, I think. So he's kind of an odd duck, fittingly, for this conversation. And it's been really meaningful for me for the past year, and I've been really happy to get to share some of that with you. Okay, thank you so much. Again, if you enjoyed what you heard, please stay tuned for next installments and other things from Money on the Left. And also please consider donating to our Patreon. We are, myself included, doing this as a labor of love, but I don't believe in a hard binary between labors of love and labors that allow you to have rent. long-winded way of saying please support us. It means the world. And otherwise, thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.